From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
I knew that I was struggling. I knew all of the things and the decisions that I was making were wrong, but I had no power to change any of it.
You'll still have to wear the good socks, Claire, because the shoes have to come off.
But I thought he'd lost quite a bit of weight and maybe he looked a little bit weaker than
don't
he has
say
done.
It, don't
I know,
say it,
sorry.
Don't say it. Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, footballer Claire Shine on her new book detailing her struggles with alcohol and drug addiction. The Boss is coming back and David McCullough is very excited. And The Fart That Changed the World is released tomorrow. That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show. That's, well, not really in the mood for gags today. We won't start the show with the traditional news plus musings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty show because, well, in the United States, the right to possess an assault rifle is more important than the right of a 7-year-old child to go to school and not be shot. As the extent of the horror in Texas became clear this morning, Ryan Tuberty shared his thoughts on how he heard the news and what he felt about it.
Waking up to that headline on the radio this morning, my heart sank. And there's footage coming in now. I find it very hard to even look at it and read about it. So we can only imagine what those parents must be feeling when they go to a school gate to find out which of the children lived and which died in this shooting in Texas. 19 children, aged between 7 and 9. I feel sick even saying that, but that's what it is. And it's not uncommon now. 19 children, that is a massacre of the innocents, and there's no way around it. You heard the report on the news there that it was quiet for so long, and then they heard the sounds of parents being told what's happening. You take a breath now. I need to take a breath now. To think about the enormity of just how sad it is, and I think in a weird way the joy we have in our lives that we can bring our children to the school gate without really any fear on a Wednesday morning and drop them off into the safety of the teachers and the students and the gunless world we live in largely here, as opposed to those poor people in America. They call him a man. The boy was 18 years old. He's hardly a man. He hit 18 and went to the gun shop because he was allowed legally. It's his right, the right to bear arms. It's this heavenly, God-given right as they see it, unfortunately, in America. Not they, all of them. Not everyone in America's bad. Let's not taint everybody. But it was his right, this young guy. And for whatever reason, he killed his grandmother. And back to his old school, 19 children and 2 teachers. The president of America said it. He's a very empathetic man, and he's the right man in a horrible crisis like this to talk about what he's seeing. He says, "I hoped when I became president I would not have to do this again." He was decrying the death of beautiful, innocent second, third, and fourth graders in another massacre. Like that's children in first and second and third class. Imagine. It's easier when you say grade, it's like as America's over there, but when you put it into an Irish context, just it makes it more real. President Biden said the parents of these children will never see them again and never have them jump in bed and cuddle with them. And there's a hollowness in your chest and you feel like you're being sucked into it, never going to be able to get out. And it's suffocating, he said, and it's never quite the same. As a nation, we have to ask, when in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? And unfortunately, I think for every president that I've been able to watch American politics over the decades, at one point, at least one point in their presidency, they find themselves asking that question. When will we stand up to the gun lobby in America? And yet nothing. Sandy Hook, nothing. Here we are today, 19 children dead, nothing. So far. It just seems that lobby is too big. And they turn around and they say, actually, it was in one of the books I was reading the other day, that's the answer. They say guns don't shoot people. People shoot people. And therefore, you should have the right to bear arms. So look, at there's nothing we're going to achieve much today other than to acknowledge what it was and what happened, and to I suppose reflect on it all. It's just sick and sad and exhausting and desperate. The nearest we had to it, I suppose, in Scotland, Dunblane, all those years ago. And it's never easy to read about or watch. But when you see the footage as it's starting to come in here on the TV in front of me of parents arriving to the school, wide-eyed, hands out, going, "Well, what's happened?" And it's beyond, as I say, beyond fathom. So I see Matthew McConaughey. I mean, he's an actor, but he spent the first 12 years of his life in this town, in Uvalde, in Texas. He's saying that it's important for every American to take a longer and deeper look in the mirror and ask ourselves, what is it that we truly value? How do we repair the problem? What small sacrifices can we individually take today to preserve a healthier and safer nation and state and neighbourhood tomorrow? And he pleaded for American citizens to renegotiate our wants from our needs. Hard one to even discuss, debate, read about, learn about, but that is all they can do, is debate it and see what matters more, the right to bear arms or the right to life, I suppose.
Well said, I think, there from Ryan Tuberty. And I know I said we wouldn't be doing the regular newsings today, but Ryan did have an interesting tidbit to share concerning everyone's favourite Charlie.
I'm glad to see, in slightly better news, that our dear friend Charlie Bird has revealed that he's going to do something that I would never do in my whole life, ever, under any circumstances, which is a parachute jump. I don't have it in me, and never would. I will climb 15 mountains, but I will not do a parachute jump. So he's going to do it, because he's Charlie Bird, intrepid reporter. And he has convinced Mick McCarthy, who we spoke to recently on the Late Late Show, to do the jump with him. So Charlie and Mick emerging from a plane for charity again. That's pretty impressive. Charlie, reporting in the Irish Independent today, Saoirse Mulgrew says that Charlie had sent out a message saying, "More good news, my great pal John Fitzpatrick, the hotelier in New York, is about to add another €100,000 to the total of fundraising, which could be heading for €3.25 million. It's been donated from John's the parents, the Fitzpatrick Memorial Fund. And I just want to tell you something else," says Charlie. "I may be teaming up with Mick McCarthy. We're hoping to do a parachute jump in July for charity." "Yes," he says, "you have read correctly, Mick McCarthy, the former Irish soccer manager. There is an interesting story to this, but that's for another time. I'm just looking for one sponsor to make it happen." Well, I'm sure that won't be long. It won't be a big search. Somebody will want to get involved. So Charlie Bird is flying at last in the sky and out of the sky. It makes perfect sense. It's always meant to happen, Charlie. So I wish you well. He's got this beautiful coffee table book that's due out in June, which myself and Vicky Phelan actually wrote separately, but together. Does that make sense? Sounds like a COVID poster. But we wrote the a foreword for that. So that'll be launching in June as well. So he's a busy man, Charlie. And between jumping from planes and producing books as well, he's not going to be found wanting or resting.
The redoubtable Mr. Bird, fearlessly taking on new challenges, as outlined on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. The need to restrict liquids in your hand luggage to 100 mils, or whatever it is, and to have to take your laptop out of your bag, along with other sundry security irritations introduced after the September 11th attacks in the United States, may be about to end. Brian O'Connell reports on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne.
Shannon Airport has installed new scanning machines, part of a €2.5 million investment. So it means restrictions on liquids of more than 100 millilitres no longer apply. So you can bring whatever volume of liquid you like once it fits in your cabin bag. So the days of fumbling for clear plastic bags and making sure you can fit everything in they're all gone. And travel time through security, it's cut in half by this new measure. The feeling now is that many airports will follow. So obviously those 100 milliliter restrictions restrictions first introduced in 2006 in response to 9/11.
So this is good news, but have all the restrictions around the liquids and the electronics, are they gone?
They're all gone. There are some other restrictions which remain, but you'll still have to wear the good socks, Claire, because the shoes have to come off. the belts, I always have one. Anyway, the belts have to come off, but really everything else can go onto that tray. You know, the electronic items, that can stay in your bag. So it really is a change. I met with John Francis, security manager for Shannon Airport, and he talked me through the changes.
You're in our central checkpoint here at Shannon.
Your boarding card is checked here, and this is the point where you have to go rooting in the bag for all those liquids. You have to take the belt off, the shoes have to come off, the piece of the gold medallion around my neck has to come off. But it doesn't.
Okay, no, not anymore. When you arrive here, there's no more restrictions on the liquids. You don't need to present them separately, so they can stay. Whatever liquids that you have can remain in your bag.
No more of those little plastic
bags. No more of the miniatures, no more of the plastic bags, and indeed no more conflict with passengers going through either. Equally, you don't have to remove electronic items. The equipment is equipped to scan these items and also to virtually remove the electronics and see what's underneath and see what's inside. In this case, it's quite different because the tools are on board the machine. It's not X-ray, it's CT scanning, so there's a rotating gantry that takes 131 images per minute. It's also explosive detection system, so it's screening the liquids to see if they are any way risky or prohibited.
And this is the first airport in Ireland to have them?
This is the first state airport. They're in other airports in Kerry and in Donegal.
So what it means then, obviously, you can, because I'm looking here and I mean people are moving through pretty quickly here.
Yeah, because you don't have to divest or break all your property down. It goes into, obviously there's less trays, so everything goes into the single tray. It's just placed onto the conveyor and the conveyor then takes it through the system and out to the other
side. Well, hang on, people are still having to take off the old shoes.
That's because we operate, because we're going through a security scanner rather than a walk-through metal detector.
So John Francis there outlining the changes, but you put it to the test yourself, Brian, did you?
I did. I put my own backpack complete with water bottle, a laptop, electronic devices. I had batteries in the backpack. All of it went through the scanner, and then I also met some passengers who had come through.
So I have my bag here. I've got a laptop in it. I have a bottle of water on the side of it.
Yes.
Various other electronic items. And I've got my phone in my back pocket.
Yes.
So what do I need to do?
You need to take a tray.
Yeah.
You need to place the bag in the tray. If you have your phone, put your phone in. If you have a belt,
yeah,
then put your belt in as well.
Okay, so that's it.
So that's all your property.
Everything goes into the tray.
And then all you do then is just push it forward.
And then tell me about the machine you walk through. There's something different about that as well. You don't put your hands up. What's the story with that?
We've now migrated to a security scanner.
I'm getting worried about my bag.
Don't worry about your bag. Your bag will be fine. We have the laptop highlighted here.
Yeah.
So if we just click that, the laptop comes up, and if we remove the laptop, then the laptop is taken out.
Very good.
We can clear that.
Yeah.
And then we can rotate this. Yeah. We can stretch it.
It's so detailed.
You can take your property away. Yeah, it really makes the job on the screener much easier and very accurate.
What do you think of this new scanning thing, lads?
Great, they should do it everywhere. Airports and clashes should stop cheaping out. I know the technology is there available, so they should spend their bucks, but it's great to see Shannon Airport at the forefront.
So for you, you're putting your shoes back on, so you just have to take off the shoes, the belt, everything else went in.
Once they get us to keep the shoes on, then that'll be perfect.
That's the next thing. Will that ever happen?
Yes, there is a module being developed for the scanner that will deliver that, but it's still in development, so it's not quite there yet. So obviously, as and when that becomes available, then we would migrate to that.
Are you heading off somewhere?
We're going to Barcelona.
Oh, fantastic.
Barcelona for a bit of sun, and we're actually from Spain, so we're just visiting my brother there as well. So
fantastic. Have a great trip.
Thanks very much.
Barcelona sure does sound good. That was Brian O'Connell's report for Today with Claire Byrne on new security procedures at Shannon Airport, meaning no restrictions on liquids, but you will still have to take your shoes off. Swings and roundabouts, I suppose. On this afternoon's Live Line, Katie Hannan spoke to John, an Irishman living in San Antonio, Texas, who's a retired school principal and still active in education there. He told Katie about his experience in the US over more than 20 years.
I'm in the inner city of San Antonio, Texas, and my population is all Hispanic. It's 99% Hispanic Latino.
Which is very similar. We know it's about 80% Hispanic Latino in this community that was hit.
These are my kids. I teach, I work in a school from pre-K, 3-year-olds all the way up to middle school, which is like 12 and 13-year-olds. Every day I walk the classrooms, I go into second grade, third grade, fourth grade classrooms. And even after all this time, you know, I've been here since 1987 and been in with this district since 91. This is just, you know, I didn't know about it yesterday because I was in school and I couldn't, like I was told, your researcher, my brothers and sisters were all texting me and calling me and I couldn't answer the phone because it's blocked by the district firewall. And I thought something had happened to somebody at home in Ireland, you know, or in England. And then driving home at, you know, 6 o'clock yesterday evening, just watching the news all night and not knowing the kids. And then you saying the kids' names this morning, you know. These are my kids. Those are the names that I've been working with for the last 30-odd years here.
And I'm just so conscious, John, of all the parents who would have to get their kids out of bed and dressed and hand them their school bags and bring them to school today, John.
Yeah, and that's, right now I'm sitting in my car in the parking lot because, you know, there's for silence and for focus and watching, you know, parents drive up and actually getting out of the car and walking their kids in today. And we have a police officer on campus here at the gate right now and all the administrators are out. I mean, I'm out every morning doing duty here, but this is the first time I've seen a police officer come all year. Well, I've only been here since February, you know. Like I said, I substitute in different schools and different areas of the district throughout the year, you know. They're fantastic people. I mean, I love San Antonio. I love the community. I love the Latino community. Yo hablo español ahora. I speak Spanish now. And they're very like the Irish because, you know, they have the Catholic faith and they have the large families and they have the whole, you know, I remember when I was growing up with 9 brothers and sisters, these are the community, these are the people that I am working with and, you know, they touch my heart so much, you know.
You're originally from Galway, John.
Yeah, I'm from Dumore County, Galway. I worked in Tuam for 6 years in the presentation as a high school music teacher. Then I moved over to San Antonio in 1987 for opportunity to become an administrator, which I did, you know. I became a principal, I became an assistant principal, a principal in the district. There's no retirement age here in San Antonio, so I didn't have to retire when I was 65 or 66, you know, which I am 66 right now. But professionally, San Antonio has been fantastic to me, you know, and the culture is beautiful, you know. So, yeah.
How much have those shootings, those school shootings, impacted on the schools that you have worked in over the last 20 years?
Yeah, well, you know, the whole security systems in the schools. And most of the campuses here in my district were under bond back about 15 years ago, right after the shooting started. So all the lobbies, all the office areas, the entrances are like double entrance now. And you have to have a code. You can't just walk in. You have to buzz in. You have to show identification. So, and we do lockdown procedures every year. You know, we do firearms, of course, every month. We do lockdown.
Yeah, describe to me what a lockdown drill would be.
A lockdown is where the administrator, like for me as the principal, we will get on the intercom system and I would say, you know, lockdown, lockdown, lockdown. And then all the teachers would close their doors, lock their doors, turn off the lights and secure the kids in an area away from the door. And they cover the window if there's a window in the door. They'll go into the bathroom if there's a bathroom there. They'll keep quiet. And then the police, the district police will come and they do a drill. They run through the campus and they knock on doors. And they test the security of the teachers. If teachers would answer the door when they were knocked on or they would just leave them locked, you know. And this takes about maybe 45 minutes. So the kids would be locked down in darkness, silence for 45 to an hour, depending on, you know, the campus, depending on the size of the campus. Last year, I remember I was at a high school and we did that for, it was an hour and a half, and actually one teacher and their kids were forgotten about. So it's a matter of, this happens every year. We do this every year. The teachers go through training at the beginning of the year, and then afterwards they give us a report. You know, the police officers give us a report on how well we did, give the administrators a report. So then we talk to the staff about that, and we say, okay, this wasn't right, or are you open the door for this? But this knocking, you shouldn't have opened it, or, you know, you should have put the child in from the restroom because, you know, anybody that's in the hallway needs to go into the nearest classroom if the lockdown drill comes on. So now it's common practice kind of thing, you know.
Common practice, obviously, we know that and we hear about it so much, but it still must be, a scary thing for a child to understand why they're doing those lockdowns.
I know, but, you know, when it becomes common practice, you become anaesthetised to it, you know. There's just so much that that has gone on that people have become accustomed to, you know? And it's so sad that we can't, you know, that we don't remain shocked. Do you know what I'm saying? And it's continuous in Sandy Hook. That was the last elementary school. I remember Dunblane, was it Dunblane in Scotland?
In Scotland, yeah.
And I'm sure the Scottish and then the Swedish and the other countries in Europe have done a whole lot more about security and about not allowing guns than we have. And especially in Texas. I mean, you know, I'm in the state of Texas and it's free carry. Anybody can carry a gun, but you can't bring them into the school. But they do want to arm the teachers now in San Antonio and in Texas, you know, the teachers should have firearms to arm themselves in case this happens again. But then if you have an unstable teacher or an unstable assistant or somebody, employee, you know, what's that going to do, you know? Or if a child gets hold of a gun of a teacher, you know, it's like crazy. There's no... Stop. Let's stop this now, you know. There's none of that. I remember Steve Kerr was on the TV last night. He's the coach of one of the big basketball teams here in the final, and he said, we have to stop this. That's what Biden said last night. We have to stop this, but we won't because of the lockjaw in the government between the Republicans and the Democrats, you know.
And would that be in the back of your mind, or would it have been in the back of your mind going into school, in, you know, going into your do your day's work, that this is something that possibly might happen, that this might be something you yourself might have to deal with?
Well, I have to deal with it every day because I'm not in the classroom and I'm walking the hallways, and so anybody that's there and doesn't have a badge, you know, needs to be, I have to always, you know, check if that happens. And again, going to different campuses that I haven't been responsible for fully throughout the year and putting my procedures in place has been difficult because sometimes the front office is not as strict as it should be, you know what I'm saying? I mean, anything can happen. I mean, I remember yesterday afternoon after this had happened and I was doing duty after school here, before I heard about this, actually, it was that there was a parent sitting outside, you know, on the phone arguing with her husband, and there were the custody fight, and she was loud and loud. She went on for about 30 minutes. So I've had issues. I mean, I've had parents arrested on my campus, you know, for custody issues. So those things, and, you know, custody issues can become very violent. And I've had to call the police a number of times for backup, and I haven't feared for my own safety, you know, because I don't know. I haven't feared for my own safety. I mean, my job is to protect the kids, not to protect myself. I mean, not that they're a martyr or anything, but, you know, I don't think about my own safety in the whole scheme of things, really, on my campus, on my school, you know.
That's Irishman John, who works in schools in San Antonio, Texas, talking to Katie Hannan on this afternoon's Live Line. Footballer Claire Shine, who plays for Glasgow City and the Republic of Ireland, has played high-level sport since she was a teenager, both as a footballer and as a camogie player. Now Claire has written a book about her struggles with drugs and alcohol called Scoring Goals in the Dark. And Claire spoke to Ryan Tuberty this morning.
Your book is striking for a number of reasons. It's called Scoring Goals in the Dark. And it's the darkness I want to travel to for a moment, if you don't mind, Claire. To talk a little bit about that. We're going to Cork, it's 2017. You were unfit at the time and you had injuries going on, and you went to a game in the Netherlands to support, you know, your friends on the team. What happened? Take your time, yeah.
Oh, okay, where do I start, to be honest? I think it was just a whirlwind at that time in my life. I had no control over my decisions. I was powerless. I think my addiction really started to affect me during those periods. And I have mixed emotions as well, because I wanted to be part of the team, but I wasn't doing the right things to look after myself, to be fit enough to go and to represent my country at that time. And I think, you know, when I went over to that game in particular, I just wanted to have a good time. And it just took complete control over me, and I ended up turning up to the game under the influence. I don't really have a lot of memory from that game. I can just remember sitting up in the stand and trying to hide the fact that I had a bottle of wine in my bag from the parents and from the supporters that travelled over from Ireland. And I was in the squad a number of months before that. And for me to be standing and watching the team that I was dying to be involved in, drinking a bottle of wine, I think that's when, you know that there is definitely something wrong. But in that moment, you know, I didn't care. I didn't care what people thought about me. I didn't care that I wasn't involved. I didn't care about anything. I only kind of thought about like where I was going to be able to have a good time, and there was nothing really getting in the way of it during that period anyway in particular.
Because, you know, it sounds quite sudden. We've gone from talking to all about your great success, and then the next thing you're at this game with a bottle of wine in the bag. But was that just because of the day that was in it and you were a bit out of control, or were you becoming, was booze becoming a problem for you to the point of alcoholism?
Yeah, 100%. I think it completely took over my life, especially during those number of years. It wasn't that particular day. There was a number of events and moments before that where alcohol was becoming a problem. You know, I was turning up to training after being in the pub for a number of hours, or turning up to games from nights out and not really having a care in the world. And that's kind of where it brought me. And it really did take over my life to a point where I had no control. Mm. And, you know, it's crazy because I had these dreams and goals and targets of becoming, a first team player with Ireland. And it was really hard for me to take that control back, because when you're in such like depths of an addiction, it takes over everything, and you just become like it's gripping, and it grabs you and it pulls you down under, and to try and make the right decisions, you know, to try and ask for help, especially in the football industry, you know, there's not a lot of people who have these issues that are out there. So there was no one for me to kind of turn to and look at who had gone through these similar situations, where I thought that there was a way out. I just kind of accepted that this was going to be my life, and this was going to be the way that I was going to kind of continue. And I had accepted that football at that level was something that I wasn't going to be able to do anymore.
God, it's so bleak, because even in the book you talk about, you said at one point, I shouldn't really have had any place in a local pub in the middle of the day where the usual crew consisted of retired men, but I didn't care. You must have been only a teenager pretty much at that stage. And then you described taking wine from the fridge, putting it into an empty water bottle so people wouldn't notice you. So you were a proper alcoholic, in the sense that it wasn't just Saturday night, Sunday night, Friday night crazy. It was intense.
Every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was every day, yeah. And it just took, you know, when you explain those situations, like I can remember a particular incident where I was in the pub and my team were playing, like girls that I would have grown up with playing football were actually playing on the telly inside in the pub.
Oh, no.
And I was kind of sitting there with a pint in front of me being like, what am I actually doing with my life? Is this the way it's going to be? And I had accepted that. I had accepted that, you know, this was my new hobby and this was the thing that I was going to do for the next number of months, and I couldn't find a way out. I knew that I was struggling. I knew all of the things and the decisions that I was making were wrong, but I had no power to change any of it. And I think that's the power of addiction and the things that people don't see. I'm not like a monster. I'm not a bad person. I have made like really bad decisions in my life, but it is my mental health and it is the addiction that brought me to making all these bad decisions. And I think that day when I was watching the girls on the TV was definitely one of the lowest moments of my life.
You describe it so eloquently, Claire, this idea of, you know, smart, intelligent, ambitious young woman, pint in the hand, TV on with the teammates playing, and thinking that awful thing going, what am I doing here? I know I shouldn't be here. I know I shouldn't have had this drink in my hand. I know I should be in the TV on that pitch. But the mind is cruel sometimes.
100%. And it's just crazy looking back now, because I'm in such a different place. I'm a lot stronger. I'm a lot more aware and self-aware of the decisions that I make. And to look back on the person that I was, it's just crazy to think that I was completely powerless over my addiction and over my mental health and my thoughts and my feelings, and I had no control over it. I couldn't change anything, even though I knew I was in the wrong and I was doing the wrong things.
The struggle continued, Claire. I mean, that brings us to October 20th, the Saturday, 2018, and you hit a wall.
Yeah, completely. And I had been on my mind a lot before. I had made the decision. It was something that was completely overpowering as well. I think anyone who has experienced suicidal thoughts knows how gripping and how hard it is to kind of take your mind away from it. You know, there was loads of nights where I lay in bed and was just kind of thinking about it. And, you know, I kind of drowned out those thoughts by taking drugs, by going to the pub, by doing things that I thought was actually helping me, when really it was just feeding those thoughts and feeding my addiction and feeding my mental health in the wrong ways. And that's kind of what it can do. And yeah, I was intoxicated that night, and it just triggered something in my mind. And you know, it was a decision that I thought was the right thing. I thought it was the only way out for me. And yeah, it just led to me kind of acting on those thoughts. And, you know, I'm thankful that it didn't leave me with serious injuries. And it kind of was an eye-opening experience for me, because I knew that I needed help. I knew I had to reach out, and I knew I had to kind of change my ways and change my lifestyle. And that's when my recovery really did start.
That's footballer Claire Shine talking to Ryan Tuberty about her new book, Scoring Goals in the Dark. Well, it was announced yesterday that Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band will be playing shows in Dublin in May of next year on what will be the Boss's first touring show in 6 years. On This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne, uber Springsteen fan and also 6-1 News presenter David McCullough joined Claire to talk all things Bruce related, including predicting that the RDS shows will open with this track from the current album, Letter to You.
The latest album, Letter to You, and I did a little straw poll of some of my mates, and everybody unanimously said, yeah, that's the opener, because it's a great rocky song, it'll get the crowd going and everything. And it's that album is interesting. Like, it's an album he's producing. He was, what, 70, I think, when it came out. He's now 72, he'll be 73 by the time these concerts come around.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that in a moment.
But,
yeah.
the album largely is about people he's lost along the way. Like, one of the songs is Last Man Standing, and it's about the, as is that song goes, it's about the lead singer in his first band, the Castillos, when he was a teenager, and he passed away.
Yes.
And Bruce suddenly realises, oh my God, I'm the only one of them left, the only one of that gang of pals from back in the day. So it's exploring themes of loss, and it's talking about how the people that are gone, they're still with you. In ways. And, you know, when he's on stage, he's channeling all the knowledge that he's gained in a lifetime of playing music from all these different musicians, some of whom are no longer with him, principally, of course, members of the E Street Band, Clarence Clemons and Daddy Federici. But he is remembering them, and as long as they are remembered, they remain alive. Their ghosts remain with us.
So listen, the age thing, right?
Yes.
He is going to be 73. Mm. I remember over, you know, the peak of lockdown, he did something with Barack Obama, didn't he?
Yeah,
it was a
podcast
thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't great.
It was shocking. And I say that as somebody who is a fan of Bruce and interested in Barack Obama. They're both very interesting, thoughtful individuals. But the problem is, you had 40-minute podcast of the two of them agreeing with each other.
Yes.
And I think you need a bit of grit in the oyster to produce a pearl. And
yes,
that certainly wasn't a pearl. They did a book of it as well, which is actually quite good.
They did. And what I watched was something on YouTube, the two of them sitting together. It was a video, and I couldn't really focus on what they were saying because I was looking at Bruce Springsteen going, that man is in his 70s and he's as fit as a flea, which we know anyway, but I thought he'd lost quite a bit of weight, and maybe he looked a little bit weaker than he has done. I know, sorry, but I'm just, my question is, can a 73-year-old man lead a gig like the ones that he used to do 6 years ago for 3 hours plus?
Yes, the answer will become apparent this time next year. I suspect he probably can. I mean, he seems to be pretty indestructible. He takes very good care of himself, obviously.
He's big into the exercise.
Something that he kind of got into when he was in his 30s, and I think it's from a mental health point of view, I think it's probably important to him as well. So the only answer I can give you is I don't know. The last time I saw him was at the Broadway show, where he was just him and a guitar on a stage. It was completely different to an E Street show, which, as you say, is very different. Now, you do have musicians that go on. Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan's still going. Very different, though, because Bob Dylan is standing there ignoring the audience and not moving around the stage very much, whereas Bruce is a completely different thing. Can he still do it? I don't know, but I'm going to pay my dollars and find out.
He could do it 6 years ago.
He certainly could, yeah. I mean, he was the two shows in Croke Park. I mean, he was still magnificent as a showman. The amount of energy he was putting in, running around the stage and everything. Like, I wish I was that fit, which I most certainly am not. And hopefully he can still pull it out of the bag.
What magical exercise is he doing? Do we know? Is he weights? Is he?
He does all that doing gym stuff. Yeah,
gym things.
Gym things. Wouldn't be into that class thing myself.
How do you feel about the venue?
Great. The RDS Arena, very familiar ground for him. He played it first in 1988 on the Tunnel of Love tour. Fantastic gig as well. And he's played it repeatedly over the years. The last time, Croke Park, I wouldn't be a huge fan of for gigs. It's just too big. I think it's not that intimate. Depending on where you are in the stadium, the acoustics can be a problem as well. The previous time he was here, 2013, I think he did a little mini tour of the country. Ed Sheeran wasn't the first, folks. He did Belfast, Limerick, Cork, and then two nights in Kilkenny. Absolutely,
which
fabulous.
I hear were from someone who was there, were great.
Was there for the whole weekend, and actually, I've heard from people who know him that he actually really enjoyed Kilkenny as well. So I was a little bit surprised maybe that he didn't stick a return engagement to Nolan Park in there. But you know, there's plenty of vacant dates on the calendars. You never know where he'll end up.
Yeah, I mean, what is it with Ireland and him? It's just an extraordinary relationship, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, part of it is he has Irish roots on his father's side, despite the surname. Which I think does mean something to him. And also there's something about the musical heritage from here. He did that Seeger Sessions tour where he was exploring American roots music, and there's a lot of Irish influences in that as well. So I think he kind of reconnected with that a bit. And I think certainly from... I interviewed him a couple of times, and he made reference to the fact that he felt, certainly from around the mid-noughties, that there was a much greater connection he felt with the audience in Ireland. And certainly he played repeated dates, particularly some of those repeated dates, you know, three or four night stands in the RDS, promoting various albums, Magic and so on, that, you know, there was just a fantastic rapport between him and the fans. Now, having said that, people tell me that the fans in Spain are much more into it. The fans in Italy are completely insane. So you never know, we might get a road trip out of this yet.
Yeah. I want to just take another blast of the music, because the E Street Band, the fact that they're with him, you know, full scene on the stage, not just one man and a guitar, just makes it that much bit more special. So let's take a listen to the live version, or part of it at least, of Born to Run. David tells me that's his ringtone on his phone.
So much to the annoyance of my colleagues, so sorry, folks.
David McCullough, 6-1 presenter and worshipper of the Church of Springsteen. And he's not wrong, let's be honest, is he? Talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the boss's upcoming-ish Irish gigs. Following on from Escape the Rooms, their first collaboration, brother and sister Stephen and Anita Mangan have published their second children's book with the Shakespearean-inspired title of The Fart That Changed the World. Stephen and Anita spoke to actor Stephen and illustrator Anita spoke to Ray Darcy this afternoon.
So Stephen, we spoke to you about the last book. Huge success. You've got the bug, I believe, have you?
I do indeed.
Yes. Yeah. And how has that changed your life?
Well, you know, at my advanced age, it's very exciting to be starting a whole new, feels like a whole new career. You know, I've been an actor for 25, nearly 30 years. And to get into writing and writing children's books, especially, which I'm really enjoying, is fantastic. You know, as an actor, you come into a project, a lot of the big creative decisions have already been made. They've got scripts and they've chosen directors and they've cast it, and you turn up, you know, halfway along the process. But with writing, you know, you're there at the beginning. It's the blank sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And I, you know, get to, I have three boys of my own who are 14, 11 and 6. And it's just, you know, I see them absorbed by screens and video games and TV, you know, like all kids, I think, these days. And I love reading so much as a kid myself. It's very nice to write stuff that, you know, they're enjoying and that they getting a kick out of.
Yes. So it's King Fabian III. And he's the one who farts and changes the world.
Do you know what? When I came up with that title, it never occurred to me that I'd be interviewed on the radio and have to say that word so many times. but he does. I mean, the idea behind the book was the butterfly effect, which I'm sure you know all about, Ray. Idea that a butterfly flapping its wings in one part of the world can set off a chain of events that might lead to a hurricane in another part of the world. So I thought it seemed like a good starting point for children, because I think often they feel that they're so small and powerless that the things they do don't really impact on the world. And I wanted to write a story where, you know, one small action led to another one, led to another one, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, to the world literally changed.
We don't know if it was involuntary or voluntary. Specified.
The inciting incident was involuntary.
Yeah. Involuntary. I mean,
it was. Okay. It's a royal fart, because I have it on a good authority that they do it too.
it's a cautionary tale as well, that don't tell lies, because King Fabian sort of credited the fart to his butler Dimmock, and that's where the problem starts, isn't it?
That's where the problem starts, because he isn't honest enough or brave enough to own up and say, I made a mistake, and to take responsibility. And we obviously have parallels, you know, inadvertent parallels in our parliament at the moment, a bit of that going on. But he doesn't. He doesn't take responsibility. He can't face up to disappointing his rather stern wife. It's a problem.
And Anita, you do the illustrations, and you obviously have great fun with them. Would Stephen have to, you know, approve, say, your image of King Fabian there?
He does have to approve it, but luckily he's approved everything I've done. He's a very good client. Yeah,
I know who wears the trousers in his family.
Yeah,
tell us. So your younger sister and you were thick as thieves, very close, which isn't a given.
Not at all. But we do. Yeah, there's three of us in the family, and we're all born within sort of 3 and a bit years of each other. Not of each other in total. We've always got on really well, and especially now as we're working together as well.
I've spoken to Stephen before about his children, and Jack was the protagonist in the first book. Now Frank is, and then Harry will be looking forward to his book. Have you got children of your own, Anita?
I do. I have two teenagers, Maddie and Si.
So they're beyond the target market then.
They are, but they are reading it, currently reading it. So, and my husband's read it, and he's way beyond the target market. but you know, saying that, I think it's one of those books that crosses all ages. You know, everybody loves it.
And it's irreverent, and it's funny, and it's
exactly
maybe even just slightly thought provoking. Yes, which is
well, you never know. I mean, that may have accidentally happened. we live in hope.
So, Stephen, the last time we spoke, you were heading into the final season of The Split. We spoke to Abby Morgan actually last week. She has a brilliant memoir out. I don't know if you know that.
I have. I've read it. Yeah,
yes, it's
fantastic.
Amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh God. Yeah. So honest.
And you were telling us about a movie
that you'd shot or just finished shooting A Gaza Weekend, which was coincidentally about a pandemic, which was shot before the pandemic. So where's that at?
That's now finished, and I think it will start appearing at some point. I mean, that's if anyone's interested in watching a lighthearted look at a pandemic. It could be the worst timing in the world for a movie, but we'll see. Yeah, it's done. I haven't seen it yet. The director, the writer-director is Palestinian, but he's based some of the time in London. So next time he's back, I'm hoping to have a look at that and see how it turned out. Yeah, it got interrupted halfway through by the real pandemic, so... We shot half of it in Israel and then the rest of it in Jordan.
There's huge Irish connections because both your parents were Irish from over in Mayo, wasn't it? Near Belmullet, Dahoma or someplace, is it?
Dahoma, yeah. Dad was from Dahoma. Mum from Gisala, which is just a couple of miles away. Yeah. Just on the mainland, looking at Achill Island. Yeah, pretty about as far west as you can go almost. So,
was it an annual trip, Anita?
Yeah.
It was. It was a very long journey up to Liverpool and then overnight on the ferry and then, across the entire country.
Yes.
With the three of us in the back playing, fighting, Stephen lying on the back of the car and Lisa and I in the footwells because we thought that was our place.
Right.
Can you imagine?
As the younger sisters.
Feeding me grapes.
Yeah, feeding grapes.
And back then, of course, the trip across Ireland from Dunleary to Dahoma. That was a big trip.
Big trip, 6.5 hours. We'd stop every time at the Longford Arms, I remember.
Right.
And it was never open. It's happened every year. You'd get there and ask for a cup of tea and be told the kitchen was shut. And we never seemed to learn that was going to happen. Driving from London to Mayo in the 70s felt like you were going to the other side of the planet. It took that long. And especially when you were, 6 or 7 years old, it just feels endless. So yeah. it did, arriving in Belmullet just felt like around the world in 80 days, it felt epic.
But then we had the reward of all our hundreds of cousins waiting for us on the beach. So it's all good.
Because it's wild over there, isn't it? The landscape is quite wild.
Yeah, oh, really wild. Yeah, yeah. No trees. Beautiful. I mean, and starkly sort of wildly beautiful.
Yes, Like if the beach wasn't there, you'd describe it as bleak.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on a good day, there's nowhere like it on Earth.
Yes, but, yes.
You know, it depends what you mean by good day. You know, it was sort of wild. I mean, I love it. And it's sort of still undiscovered because it's not on the, it doesn't have the tourist.
No, you still have to drive forever to get to it, Stephen.
Our uncles had a dance hall in Belmont called Palm Court, and we would sit with the band before they went on. Big Tom and Margot, all sort of big hits.
And early Boyzone as well.
Boyzone played there at one point. Yeah,
did they?
Yeah, they did.
So is book three then? Is have you sat down to think about that, or is it finished?
No, I'm so busy, finishing, because I was, I played Scrooge over Christmas in the theatre in London, and when I should have been writing the book, really. So I've just kind of finished that. Anita's done all the illustrations. It's out tomorrow. And then that we start thinking about the next book soon. But it'll have to have someone called Harry as its main character.
Yes.
I don't think there are any other children's books with a Harry as a main character either, so I should be okay.
We've done our research. Yeah. I don't think there are.
So finally, fart. Putting fart in the title of a book.
Yeah.
Was there much debate about that?
Well, actually, the publishers did say initially, can we make it the burp that changed the world? And I did put my foot down, if that's an appropriate expression. It just seems to me funnier, the way it is, fart that changed the world, because hopefully it's an intriguing title. You think, how can one of those change the world? Yeah. But like I said, I didn't think it through. We did Alan Titchmarsh, his show.
Yes.
And he said, I've been in broadcasting for 40 years. I've never said that word on the television before. So we are changing people's careers by making them say that word.
It also allows you to say the fart that changed the world is released.
Oh, yes.
There you go.
Well, it has the smell of success about it.
Hey.
Ray Darcy getting the last gag in there. Ray was talking to actor Stephen Mangan and his illustrator sister Anita about their second children's book together, The Fart That Changed the World. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, the Irish laureate for fiction Cullum Tobin joined Claire in studio, and she asked him about Vinegar Hill, his recently published poetry collection, and how writing poetry compares to writing fiction.
It's completely different. It's like writing a song. You know, in other words, I did write poetry when I was a teenager and then I stopped. I have to say there was no great mourning in the country when I stopped. In other words, it wasn't as though there was anyone saying that the next Seamus Heaney has just left us. You know, in other words, I wasn't any good. I couldn't find a way of doing it. And so there's 30 years where I didn't write any poetry. And then I started again, just, you know, the odd time, one or two a year. And then during the pandemic, I did much more. I had long days to myself. And in that time, any memory I had or any thought or any idea or anything at all, I would write down and follow it and just see what the next line might be. And suddenly these poems started. Mm-hmm. I would work on them every day and it was a bit of a miracle. And I was,
but did you
surprised.
Stop all those years ago because you felt I'm not very good at this? And then what's it like to resume?
It didn't come. It just wasn't. It isn't this process of where you're walking along the street and a line comes to you and then a second line, you could go home and get a third. It just stopped. It just simply wasn't there. And I think anyone who writes poetry knows this, that you could get a year when there's no poem for a year, and then it will come strangely. It really is about inspiration. It is a sort of miraculous thing.
You mentioned COVID and the pandemic, and you found some inspiration. I was reading September, which I love. I love. Could you recite it for us?
It's a sonnet, and it's true. And it was a Sunday morning, and I spent out on the street, and this episode occurred. The problem is if to get home quickly enough where the first line comes and you start working to see if you could get it down into a sonnet what has just happened on the street. So it's one of those poems that was written on the same day as the experience occurred. So the poem is called September. The first September of the pandemic, the skies are watercolour, white and grey, and Pembroke Street is empty and so is Leeson Street. This is the time after time, what the world will look like when the world is over, when people have been ushered into seats reserved for them in the luminous heavens. Moving towards the corner of Upper Pembroke Street and Leeson Street, an elderly man wears a mask. His walk is sprightly, his movements brisk. I catch his watery eye for a watery moment. Without stopping, all matter of fact, he says, "Someone told me you were dead."
I just love it. Are you somebody? That's what it brings. That's what it brings to mind.
Someone told me you were dead.
It's like remembering a dream, isn't
it? Yeah.
You've got to do it quickly.
Yes, yes. It's also that pandemic, that streets that would have people in them and cars. You got on a Sunday morning, there was no one at all on the street. And the sky, Dublin sky can have that thing sometimes. Just a lot of cloud, but it's luminous cloud. It's all light. Mm-hmm. And this fellow walking along, just passing. And he didn't even stop.
You love
I don't know
it,
who
though.
He was.
You love it. It's so Dublin. Yeah. But you see, he was nearly right because you had a bad health incident. You were nearly dead.
That I had cancer and and that I was dead. Yeah.
And you say that cancer, the experience of it, didn't change you, or you didn't come out of that experience saying, "Oh, I've found a new appreciation of life." And I love your explanation for that because you say if you didn't appreciate life before something awful happens to you, well, you've got questions to answer, right?
Yeah, my feeling, I suppose, was that if you need chemo to really remind you of how great life is, then there's something wrong with you before. I mean, I found it really tedious, boring, painful, and I wanted it to be over. And, you know, I started dreaming about things. I mean, when I was awake dreaming, things like marinating a steak. I've never marinated. I wouldn't even know. Honestly, I would know toilet duck better than I'd know a marinade. Do you know what I mean? And
what was that about?
Why was I? Because you can't taste. Then anything to do with taste really begins to preoccupy you. And what happens then is, you know, my eyebrow, I mean, I was going to say I went bald, but I was bald anyway. But things grow back. I mean, your eyebrows grow back and stuff and your taste comes back. It all is so gradual. And then you're back in business. But it isn't as though I haven't had a drink since. And I haven't had a drink because chemotherapy itself is a form of, it's liquid and it changes your mood and gives you a sort of hangover. And when it's over, you think, I don't want any more of that. Mm-hmm. The idea of taking in red wine, that would go through your veins in the same way as chemo does.
Really?
And that would weaken you.
And that's
the idea of it would really sicken me. So I haven't been near drinks for all that time.
Yeah, I can understand that being the case soon afterwards and maybe for a period of 6 months. But it's like childbirth, like you forget.
Yeah, except you don't forget, Claire, because you see other people drinking and you think, why would I want to be like that?
So the red wine is gone.
Red wine is gone.
Mm-hmm. But no new appreciation for the birds and the flowers and the grass and the walking.
Except everyone in Dublin really has a problem with seagulls. I mean, you know, and because it was the summer when I was lying on the sofa and it was, you know, I got a sense of just how enormous the noise they make, the shrieking, the babies, the amount of, you know, they come just before the dawn. And the dawn can be early. So at 4:15 in the morning, they start squawking over your house. And then they spend the day making even more noise. And I have a big appreciation for the nuisance caused by seagulls.
Yeah, and they're huge. They are like dogs. I was looking at one only very recently, marvelling at the size of it. It was like a lamb. Yeah. You've written an opera too?
Yes, in Wexford, I did an adaptation of my novel, The Master, the novel about Henry James, and I did a libretto for an Italian composer called Alberto Caruso. And we worked very hard on it. Work's gone on for a long time. And finally, in end of October in Wexford, it's going to be performed. So it's going to be great to see it.
Another completely new experience. For you.
Yeah, it's something I've always wanted to do because I love opera and I love classical music and I love all forms of music, but writing your own songs and getting someone to compose them and hearing it for the first time, and there's a lullaby, you know, I've just written a lullaby. What are you doing today? I'm writing a lullaby for an opera, you know.
Wonderful. And in your role as Laureate, the last time you were on, you were talking to us about the book club. And Claire Keegan was the first author that you were looking at. How's that been going?
How has it worked? It's been going great. We had Colin Barrett's book, which I think is just coming up now. We did George Moore's novel, Esther Waters, which is not as well known as it should be. And we're going on to do Mary Lavin's book in the library in Dunleary on The Day After Tomorrow. So in the middle of the field. So we're sort of moving from a book that's just out, a contemporary book, to an older, you know, to books that people might have read years ago. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's going great.
And this is the bit where you tell us that we are much better readers than the Americans. We appreciate literature so much more than the Americans.
I think there's a way here that a new book here can really matter. And I think the way a new writer can emerge and people pay so much attention to that, I think that's happened here. It's happened here over the last few years, particularly with writers like Sally Rooney, Colin Barrett, Nisha Dolan, Belinda McKeown, those sort of writers. People are really, really paying attention to them, and they seem to spread over generations. It isn't just young people are reading them, even older people are reading them. And yeah, there's an absolute response to new fiction here.
Wexford's own Colm Tobin, the Irish Laureate for Fiction, talking to Claire Byrne about, well, lots of things literature related, including his recently published poetry collection, Vinegar Hill. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on the show on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another episode of Playback Daily at the same time tomorrow. Until the next time, for me, thank you for listening. And good luck.